coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A recent report found there's value for Delaware in the use of solar by homes and businesses.
The top line conclusions, it was very, very clear. It was that the benefits significantly outweighed the costs of net metering by a margin of almost 4-1.
Contributor John Hurdle examines why the report is bullish on net metering solar. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about a troubling rise in colorectal cancer in people under 50. Arts Playlist heads to the Delaware Art Museum to preview an exhibition on noted American painter and printmaker John Sloan. And History Matters explores new life for a historic church in Smyrna. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As state officials and lawmakers look for ways to help Delawareans facing rising utility prices, one long-term answer could be solar, specifically something known as net metering solar for homes and businesses that install solar panels. A recent report produced for the Delaware Sustainable Energy Utility, also known as Energize Delaware, suggests investment in net metering produces significant benefits. This week, contributor John Hurdle takes a closer look at the report and what it could mean for the first state in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And John joined me this week to discuss what he learned. So, John, let's start with the basic explanation of what we're talking about here. What is net metering solar, and where does Delaware stand right now in this area?
Net metering refers to if you have solar panels on your house or on your office, and you use the electricity generated by the panels for your own purposes, and then you have you generate excess electricity, you generate more than you actually need for your home or your business, and then you sell the excess back to your utility, and that's called net metering. And so what that results in is your electric meter literally going backwards. And those meters have the capacity to do that. And the reason that this has come up now is that net metering in Delaware does have limits, and the demand for it is running up against those limits. And so there's discussion amongst advocates and others about maybe the state should raise its limits and encourage more net metering.
So with that in mind, I guess that comes to the next question I have, which is, why was this report done? I guess it was to kind of look at where things stand and if doing more would actually be a benefit to Delaware. Is that correct? That was kind of the whole purpose of this?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, essentially what the report set out to do was to calculate whether the benefits of solar and in the industry jargon, this is called distributed generation, whether those benefits outweigh the costs or vice versa. And this is the first time that this exercise has been done for the state of Delaware. And it was carried out by an independent sustainable energy consultant based in New Jersey. The topic has been discussed by the Energy Stakeholders Group. That's a group of utility executives, environmentalists, consumer advocates, state regulators that have been brought together by State Senator Stephanie Hansen. And I've been hearing that there's been a lot of there was a lot of disagreement between the members of this panel, and so. The suggested solution was that there should be a so-called value of solar study commissioned, and that was done in the hope that that would settle the arguments. And so that report was commissioned by Energize Delaware, and this is the result that we've just seen published recently.
What were the top line conclusions of the report? What did it find about the value of solar?
Well, the top line conclusions, it was very, very clear. It was that the benefits significantly outweighed the costs of net metering by a margin of almost 4-1. It calculated that every dollar spent on net metering resulted in $1.28 in direct benefits. And what they mean by direct benefits is that this is cost savings to customers who clearly don't have to pay as much or not at all for the electricity that they might otherwise pay to their utility, and also a reduced cost for grid operators because they don't have to supply as much power or do as much maintenance as a result of that. And so, essentially, they concluded, well, the more net metering there is, the more benefits there are.
And I guess from the customer side, it sounds like there is like some real benefits that while there may be a front-end investment to put these things up, even with whatever tax breaks or incentives are included in it, ultimately it winds up being a good deal for a consumer.
Well, indeed, that was one of the things that the report concluded. Consumers who make this investment, they have lower or even no electricity costs as a result of the solar generated. There's no carbon emissions, and they can the advocates will argue that there's actually relatively low capital costs involved in putting a solar array on your house or your business. So the argument runs that you can get a pretty low interest loan through Energize Delaware, and you use that to put the solar array on your property, and then within, let's say, half a dozen years, the effectively free electricity that you're receiving effectively pays off the cost of that loan, and after that, it's so-called money in the bank.
How about from the utility and grid side of the equation? You mentioned some of the benefits that they mentioned in the top line. Can you dive a little bit deeper in there? What when we talk about lowering maintenance and things like that, how much of a benefit is that to the utility and grid side of things?
Well, it was striking. I got a statement from Delmarva Power, which is of course, the major electricity supplier in the state, which was, well, I guess you could characterize as cautiously welcoming this report. They said that they support the expansion of clean energy, including what they referred to as customer-sited solar. And they said that the report had provided what they called important insights. And so, they urged lawmakers to approach the issue of possibly raising the statewide limit on net metering in a very thoughtful way. I think it sounds like Delmarva Power isn't advocating that the state should go into this sort of head first, but thinking hard about what the implications are. But overall, the utility seemed to be in favor of the idea.
John, one issue often brought up when net metering is discussed is a concern that it creates a cost shift to non-solar customers, basically subsidizing the net metering customers. What did the report find about that? Is that something that does in fact happen or not?
Well, no. The report concluded that there was in fact no subsidy. The argument runs is that if a solar customer does not pay money to the utility, then I mean, under normal circumstances, if the utility supplies electricity to that customer, then a portion of that consumer's bill will go towards things like maintenance and transmission costs and so on and so forth. And so the argument runs is that if a solar generating customer is not paying that money to the utility, then they are still benefiting from the utility's services, i.e., they're selling their own power, or they may be selling their own power to the utility, and they're doing so without actually sharing the cost of that. So that's the negative aspect here. But the report dismisses that and said that there is actually no subsidy. It points out that it reduces the overall that net metering reduces the overall cost of energy. It include improves grid resiliency because there's less demand on the grid. It cleans the air and it creates jobs. And so in the report's telling, this was is a win-win.
So clearly, the report's pretty bullish on net metering solar. And one thing you've kind of alluded here is, Delaware, can build on this in some ways. Specifically, I guess, changing the cap on net metering. Tell us what that could look like. Where is that cap now, and what could be done to change it?
Well, the cap now is at 8%, and what that means is that utilities, that state law says that utilities may choose not to accept new net metering customers after existing customers have reached 8% of the total monthly peak demand. And in some cases, what we're hearing is that net metering customers are already reaching that limit. And so what the report is saying is that Delaware lawmakers should consider raising that cap in order to reap all of the benefits that we've been talking about. And in the course of doing the report, they ran a scenario of what would happen if the state raised its net metering cap to 18, 18%. And they concluded that the benefits still outweighed the costs of doing that. Now, I mean, I spoke with Drew Slater, who's the executive director of Energize Delaware, and I was pressing him on what limit should be placed on the net metering, and he wasn't willing to specify a number. But he made it clear that he thought that it was appropriate that Delaware should raise its net metering limit, and of course that is that's up to lawmakers to decide what the appropriate limit is. But there seemed to be general agreement that it should go up.
So, any sense of a general reaction to this report? I know it's still kind of early on, and I guess specifically, a sense of maybe the appetite for raising that net metering cap.
Well, I listened into the latest meeting of the Energy Stakeholders Group, and there seemed to be general support amongst those folks. And when you consider that the people on that committee represent a pretty broad range of interests, whether it be, utilities or consumer advocates or environmentalists and so on, state regulators, that, I mean, there was no or very little pushback against the idea that I heard during that session. So it would seem that there probably is fairly broad-based support for this idea. But again, we have to see what the legislature has to say about it.
So to wrap up, given the current climate surrounding utility bills in Delaware, which we've heard a lot about in the last few months, and hurdles that other energy alternatives like offshore wind are facing these days, does it feel like net metering holds some real potential for a state like Delaware, particularly if maybe they take an incremental approach toward, say, like increasing this cap and encouraging this kind of thing?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, obviously, as you pointed out, the report itself is very bullish on and it's very specific on the benefits to consumers of getting into the internet metering. I mean, clearly there are costs, individual cost savings involved. There's climate benefits. And the other one other point that the report makes is that net metering is very easy to understand. It's kind of an easy sell for the consumer. People advocates will say, well, hey, you can reduce your electricity costs by maybe 100% or some high proportion, and it seems like there's no reason not to do it. So it does seem like presumably these ideas will filter down to the legislature, and maybe there'll be fruitful discussions as a result of that. But that's the next step in this process.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece on net metering solar in the first state is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We examine an alarming surge in colorectal cancer rates among young people and what's being done to address it. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Colorectal cancer rates in adults over the age of 50 have been falling since the 1980s. But that's not the case for young adults. New research shows that colorectal cancer incidences and deaths are increasing in people under 50. And if that trend continues, colorectal cancer is expected to become the leading cause of cancer-related deaths among young adults globally by 2030. Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down this week with Dr. Asar Rather, a colorectal surgeon with Bay Health, to examine the rise in colorectal cancer for young people and how it's being addressed.
First, with colorectal cancer and colon cancer, those are two different things, right?
That's correct. These are like apples and oranges. It's the same conduit, but rectal cancer treatment is totally different from colon cancer treatment. And we can go into the details, but yeah, most people think colon or rectum, the treatment is the same. It's not. These are two different cancers.
So then for colorectal cancer specifically, what causes it? I'm sure I know there's a number of contributing factors that I'm sure we're about to talk about, but speaking broadly though, what causes colorectal cancer?
Well, the short answer is we don't know. Right. We have there are a lot of, you know, we look at lifestyle. Mostly we talk about lifestyle when it comes to colorectal cancer. Lifestyle meaning, you know, people sedentary lifestyle, overweight, being overweight, you know, increased consumption of alcohol, smoking. Basically, that is the number one thing that we're looking at is a healthy lifestyle decreases the risk of colorectal cancer. Then you talk about familial cancers and inherited cancers or hereditary cancers. What that means is that hereditary means that there's a gene that is runs in the family and that puts you at a high risk. Familial cancer means that there's a pattern in the family, but we have not been able to isolate that specific gene which contributes to colon and rectal cancer. But we are mostly talking about the lifestyle when it comes to the cause for colorectal cancer, and that's number one reason.
Yeah, and I want to dive more into those lifestyle, you know, what that entails in a bit here. But, you know, typically it's older adults who are diagnosed. So why are we seeing this increase in younger folks as far as colorectal cancer rates go?
Yeah, Kyle, you're right. It's still a cancer of old age, but unfortunately, what we have seen over the last 15, 20 years is an uptick in the number of younger patients diagnosed with colorectal cancer. If you have to compare, in 1995, 1 in 10 patients diagnosed with colorectal cancer were less than 55. And as per the American Cancer Society in 2019, the number has gone up to 1 in 5, which means 20% of patients diagnosed with colorectal cancer nowadays are less than 55. Why? I think we have done a good job when it comes to screening for colorectal cancer in elderly patients, or I would say greater than 45. The screening age did go down a couple of years ago from 50, it used to be 50, it's 45 now. So we've done a good job when it comes to screening, and we pick up, we remove those polyps and which contributes to cancer in a lot of cases. The question is, why are we seeing uptick? And again, the short answer is, we don't know. We still blame it on, you know, we do see a higher incidence in, you know, patients who are overweight, who are more sedentary, who don't consume a lot of fiber, drink a lot of alcohol and smoking and other risk factors. So that is pretty much what we are looking at right now.
So as a colorectal surgeon at Bay Health, I know you're seeing this there, boots on the ground, but is there anything about your day-to-day as far as younger folks and colorectal cancer goes? Is there anything about your day-to-day that sticks out, I guess, on that score?
Yeah, I mean, the unfortunate part is that younger patients feel like, you know, there's no need to see a doctor. We're not going to get sick, right? You know, I'm not going to have cancer. So I think if you ask me, we see this in, you know, real time. In my practice, we have it's very similar. The numbers are very similar to what the national numbers are, about 20% or less than 55. So the key is if you see something, say something, right? If you have symptoms that are not going away, don't ignore symptoms. Don't be under this impression that you're young and you're not going to have cancer. So I think if I have to, you know, that's a common theme many times. Oh, you know, I have some rectal bleeding. It could be XYZ. I'm never going to have cancer. And and they delay treatment. The colorectal cancer is curable if you pick it at an early stage. So that is the key. If you detect it at an early stage, you can cure colorectal cancer. But unfortunately, sometimes people don't see a doctor, they delay their symptoms and may present at an advanced stage. And at times it is way advanced. We're not able to help those patients.
It's almost like you know what questions I'm going to ask next because I was going to ask you about signs and symptoms and what you. I know you mentioned rectal bleeding. Is there anything else? I'm sure this could depend on a number of things in terms of you know maybe age or gender, or demographic, whatever. But are there signs and symptoms that we should be keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, absolutely. So rectal bleeding, which is not going away, we don't want to alarm the population, everyone. Hey, if there's rectal cancer, if there's rectal bleeding, you have colorectal cancer. The key is rectal bleeding, which is not going away, right? You know, people can have hemorrhoids, people can have other causes of rectal bleeding, but if it is ongoing, if it is lasting more than what you know, 5 days, then you have to see a doctor. If there is change in bowel habits, some people have diarrhea, they're regular, they go every day, and all of a sudden they see a change in their bowel pattern. They either have diarrhea or they get constipated. So don't ignore those symptoms. Go and see a doctor. If you see stool is narrow, the caliber has gone down, you see stringy stool, that's a concern. People who feel they're tired and there's really no reason for them to be tired at such a young age. Unintentional weight loss. Intentional weight loss nowadays, is okay. But if you don't intend to weight loss, you're not doing anything about it, and suddenly you're losing weight, that's not good. So again, any of those symptoms, don't ignore. If these symptoms are persistent, go call a physician, your family doctor, gastroenterologist, colorectal surgeon, and get checked.
So if we catch it early, what does treatment look like then? And I'm also curious, when would something like, you know, your end of things as far as surgery goes, or your specialty or whatnot, you know, what stage, how advanced does it have to be, you know, when it comes, you know, when surgery needs to, you know, happen?
Yeah, so that's where the difference comes in colorectal cancer. You ask this question, what's the difference? When we look at etiology, meaning what causes colorectal cancer, it's pretty much the same for both colon and rectum. It's the treatment part that's different for colon and rectum. The staging is, you know, most of the colon cancers need upfront surgery, meaning, you know, diagnosed with colon cancer, you go, you have an operation. If they are curable or they're not advanced stage, meaning we are even able to cure some stage 4 colorectal cancers nowadays. You know, stage 1, stage 2, stage 3 is curable. Even some stage 4s are curable nowadays. For colon cancer, treatment typically involves surgery upfront, meaning first we go for surgery, and then we decide whether patients need chemotherapy or not. Not everyone needs chemotherapy in colon cancer. Stage 1 and 2, they don't need chemotherapy. Stage 3, they typically need chemotherapy. And yes, stage 4 patients need chemotherapy as well. As far as rectal cancer is concerned, it's different. So rectal cancer, I just also want to add, nowadays, cancer care is individualized. It's not like everyone is treated the same way, especially rectal cancer. Rectal cancer, highly individualized nowadays, involves a combination of chemotherapy, radiation therapy, surgery, and in a very small subset of patients, immunotherapy.
Well, you mentioned lifestyle earlier as far as being a big-time contributing factor here, as much as, you know, there's still a bit of a fog around, you know, what causes colorectal cancer. But there is new research out there that I actually mentioned off-air before this call that, you know, it's showing essentially that damage from gut bacteria could play a role in this rise that we're seeing in young adults. So I've also read just different reports on how the consumption of, you know, something like processed foods or even types of dairy or milks can play somewhat of a role here. Again, I think it all just goes to the what you were saying earlier about as far as diet and lifestyle and whatnot. So again, what are your thoughts on all of that, and how and just how big of a role our lifestyle and our diet plays in this?
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned about gut bacteria. We call that in medical language microbiome. There is there are good bacteria and bad bacteria. That's how we look at things. And there's a balance, right? So when there's an imbalance, and that imbalance comes from, again, the diet, you tend to have more. There is possibly, we are looking at, there's a lot of research into role of microbiome in colorectal cancer and other diseases, and as you mentioned, processed food as well. So there's no doubt, over being overweight, not consuming enough fiber, you know, that means fruits and vegetables, and consuming a lot of processed food has been shown to increase the risk of colorectal cancer. So if I have to give one advice, that's what I would recommend is, you know, stay healthy, eat fiber, drink. Make sure you're getting 30 grams of fiber every day. Make sure you're drinking a lot of water, which is about 64 ounces of water every day. And try to cut down on your processed food consumption and alcohol and smoking. That is still the number one, focus when it comes to cause of colorectal cancer.
Thanks to Dr. Asar Rather, a colorectal surgeon with Bay Health, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist and a trip to the Delaware Art Museum for a look at an exhibition highlighting the work and teachings of one of the most significant American painters and printmakers of the 20th century. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. John Sloan is one of the most important American painters and printmakers of the 20th century. Best known for his gritty realist paintings of working-class life in New York City, Sloan was a founding member of The Eight, a group of artists who rejected academic traditions and focused on depicting urban life. But his biggest impact came as an art instructor, something the Delaware Art Museum showcases in its John Sloan and His Students exhibition. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny catches up with Delaware Art Museum curator Heather Campbell Coyle for a chat about Sloan and the exhibit highlighting his work and teachings.
Tell me about this exhibition, the works of John Sloan and His Students.
So this exhibition is actually looking at John Sloan's role as a teacher. It's John Sloan and His Students. So most of the work is actually by Sloan's students. And this exhibition includes about 40 works of art, all from the Delaware Art Museum's permanent collection. Some of them actually belong to Sloan in his lifetime. And these are the works by him that relate to his teaching in some way, specifically his teaching at the Art Students League of New York, and then works by his students who studied with him there. This exhibition was assembled in part to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Art Students League, which is being celebrated this year.
Let me ask you about the history of the Art Students League and the role that it's played in American art.
Sure. The Art Students League is one of the most prolific art schools in the nation, founded in 1875, as arts things often are, by a bunch of younger artists who weren't happy with the other art school, big art school in New York, the National Academy of Design. They founded this at the time, sort of more liberal program. So the Art Students League is also, it's a cooperative. It's run by the students to a large degree. They have a student board and they choose a president from their faculty. So it is, it's always been a very kind of progressive art school in that sense, and a very much a community school. You can take classes there, or you could for a long time, for as little as a month at a time. So kind of everybody studies there. And one of the things about the Art Students League is that study there in Sloan's time and before was really focused on figure study, on the human figure. So many artists would go there and take classes, even if they had other art training, in order to have, just better grasp of figure drawing and figure painting.
How long did John Sloan teach at the League?
So he starts in 1916, teaches regularly through the early 30s, then leaves for a couple of years after a spat with the board, and then comes back and teaches, I believe, 35 to 37. So almost 20 years of students coming through, which is an enormous number of people. There's over, I think we have a spreadsheet with over 250 artists whose names we know of.
How was Sloan as a teacher?
Sloan seems to have been a very inspiring teacher. His students really come together behind him. Some of the fun things that you'll see in the exhibition are photographs, but also a magazine that his students put together that they called the Sloanian Nut. So this was a sort of unofficial organ of the league or of his students specifically. Really, they called they called themselves Sloanian Nuts. They were that much, that well devoted to their teacher. He certainly absorbs many students into his life, has lifelong friendships with some of them, collects their art. His second wife is one of his students. After the death of his first wife, he marries one of his former students, Helen Farr. And it is, of course, due to her that we have this extraordinary collection at all.
When you look at the work of Sloane's students, I wonder if you see elements of his style showing up in their work.
Absolutely. And also, absolutely not. It totally depends on the student. Sloane was very much pushing artists to, get out and explore. He wasn't a particularly modernist artist. He's always painting figures and places, recognizable things. But he is encouraging his students to go see the most, progressive art that is out there in New York. So he is a teacher for some of the abstract expressionists like Barnett Newman and Adolph Gottlieb. But he's also, many of his students certainly pick up kind of where he leaves off. So Sloane had, in the beginning of his career, and by the time he lands at the League, Sloane is best known as a painter of city pictures. He is known for painting sort of everyday life in New York, particularly women moving through the city. And the architecture of the city, the amusements, particularly of the city. And actually, in his time at the League, he would begin doing more figure painting and his own path would shift. The last third of his career is almost all nudes and portraits. But many of his students, and actually many American artists, really pick up where Sloane and his Ashcan School colleagues leave off in the teens, and city painting becomes ever bigger deal as you get into sort of the social realist and American scene painting of the 30s. So many of his students' works, you certainly see a sense of that interest in the life around them. Some of the really fun pictures in the show are actually images of artists working at the League. There's one of Sloane giving a lecture. There's others of the lunchroom there. There's images from Coney Island. So there's definitely there's a Helen Farr Sloane of a speakeasy in the early 30s. So there's a sense of sort of the city around them that was certainly Sloane's milieu in many of the works. But then there's also works that are completely non-objective. There's an Alexander Calder print. There's an that don't look anything like Sloane's works. And I think it, to some degree, you get a sense of artists looking more like his work earlier in their careers. But some artists really stick with that. I mean, the interest in painting, life in the city is something that, well, kind of still happens, right?
I love how you talk about him as this evolution in his career moving toward painting more figures and this notion of, yes, he's a teacher, but also kind of a lifelong student as well, taking his craft in new directions.
Absolutely. Sloane says in the book Gist of Art, which is about, his work as a teacher and things he taught his students, but he says that, he started figure painting really to stay a little ahead of his students, began doing much more figure drawing and much more figure painting. And he's always trying to evolve and try new things. I am convinced to this day that most of the artists I know age better mentally than anyone else because they're always curious, always trying and exploring new things.
Tell me about the Ashcan School.
Sure. So this is one of the real strengths of the collection here at the Delaware Art Museum. Sloane and several of his friends, they get to know each other in Philadelphia. This is John Sloane, Robert Henri, George Lukes, William Glackens, and Everett Shin. Some of them, other than Henri, they're working at the newspapers. They're really grounded in drawing everyday life because it's their job. And then they slowly, one by one, begin to move to New York, many of them working as illustrators, Henri working as a teacher throughout all of his career. And they are get known in the early 20th century for painting everyday life in New York. You have lots of painting people painting pictures of sort of upper middle class life. You have American Impressionists giving you that sort of distant view of the city, all with beautiful mist or snow to kind of make a really pretty picture. What the Ashcan School artists become known for, although they're doing lots of other things, are pictures of sort of ordinary people, often in lower Manhattan. Lukes is painting a lot of images of the Lower East Side and the immigrant populations there. Sloane is painting in Chelsea and Greenwich Village, capturing the working class and artistic populations down there. And it's hard for us to look at his paintings now and be like, that's revolutionary. But people were so offended by some of these works when they were first being shown, 1905, 1908, 1910. So the Ashcan School, for a brief moment, is really pushing forward modernism in America by focusing on modern life as well as a modern style. But in 1913, with the advent of the Armory Show, which brings all of European modernism to a broad American audience, Brancusi and Duchamp and Cubism and Matisse, it all sort of lands in New York for a month in February of 1913 and blows everybody's minds. And all of a sudden, Sloane and his circle aren't the most progressive artists anymore. But for a moment, that Ashcan School group is really leading the way.
As you're talking about getting into the less stylish corners of society, my mind jumped to what was going on in literature at that time, writing people like Upton Sinclair, Jacob Riis, also sort of shocking people with raw portrayals of how people live.
Right. And some of those people are running in similar circles. There's a lot of literature being done about everyday life in New York, about the less glamorous, about the difficulties of moving to the city. And these artists and these literary folks are running in the same circles sometimes.
What do you hope museum goers will take away from this exhibition?
I think it's a really interesting cross-section of modern American art that's being made by artists who sort of come out of the same milieu and go in very different directions. And I think that's a really exciting opportunity. But also, I love that idea of teaching and lifelong learning being a really important part of what I want people to see too. We have a wonderful studio program here. Like, go out, take an art class. You might get inspired to do something really interesting.
Are there particular works in the show that really just stand out to you?
I think one of the things that stood out to me when I pulled this show together, I wasn't consciously thinking about this. It wasn't really till I was installing it that I realized the number of works by Sloane's female students. So the early 20th century is a time that more women are coming into art schools. More women are coming into lots of professions, right? There's just more opportunities and how the strength of that work. And the playfulness of that work. I particularly adore the work of Peggy Bacon myself because she is funny as well as a great graphic artist. But yeah, just to get to see some of these works by women artists, some of whom their names aren't going to be as familiar, but they need some more study. People need to learn more about them. So hopefully people will get their eyes opened.
And about how many works are there in the exhibition?
It's about 40 works and then some things from our archives because we not only have the largest collection of Sloane's work. We also have his personal papers here. So we have 300 boxes and drawers of his letters and diaries and things he saved. So some of that will be in the show as well. We have over 2,500 works by Sloane. Most of those are prints and drawings, but over 80 of them are paintings. It was given to us all by his student and second wife, Helen Farr.
Thanks to Delaware Art Museum curator Heather Campbell Coyle and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we finish out the green next with History Matters, where we learn more about Odessa's 19th century Zur Church and its long-awaited restoration after closing its doors a decade ago. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Zur Methodist Episcopal Church in Odessa is among 30 historically black churches nationwide, receiving a share of an $8.5 million grant for restoration work. The Zur Church was originally established in 1845 and has been in need of a significant makeover since shuttering its doors in 2015. Now, thanks to the National Trust for Historic Preservation's funding, that process is underway. It includes restoring the church's stained glass windows and reimagining it as a community and historical center. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry is joined by Stephen Johnson, the treasurer for Friends of Zur, the grassroots advocacy group that secured the grant, to learn more about the Zur Church's restoration efforts and plans to preserve its history.
Given that the church shuttered its doors in 2015, can you give us some insight into what your initial thoughts were when you first heard that Zur was among the 30 to receive this funding?
Well, we were, of course, overjoyed. And we had tried once before and had been turned down. So this was actually a second attempt. And we were fortunate to be named as one of those 30 churches. So it was a great honor that we were able to be chosen and to receive the funding for the restoration of this very historic building.
Now, you said this was the second attempt. After that first attempt, well, when was that first attempt? And did you just feel down like it wasn't going to happen at all?
Well, no. Actually, we had not moved far enough along the way in the process of planning by virtue of an architectural plan, a budget. And so they encouraged us to apply again as we moved further along in the process. So we were, unfortunately not chosen the first time, but again, the second time was a charm.
Do you know how much funding Zohr is specifically receiving?
We do. We received a grant of $250,000 from NTHP.
Where are you right now in this process then? Has the funding been dispersed, or are you still waiting on that in the planning phase of things?
We are still awaiting the funds. They will distribute the money in three installments over the course of the work that's going to be done. The money specifically is earmarked for a replacement of the roof on the church building, the exterior brick restoration, as well as the replacement of a belfry on the church building that was there many, many years ago, but has disappeared since that time. As far as the planning process, our architect has completed all of his work. We've received a mechanical, electric, plumbing plan from an engineering firm. And we did employ a construction manager, a fellow by the name of Ed Ide, who has done historic restoration around Delaware. He also built the Odessa Firehouse that presently stands in historic Odessa. And so he is working with us on the individual trades that are going to be doing the work, the construction on the building. Right now, we have received bids from three different groups, mechanical, HVAC, electric, and plumbing. And we'll be making decisions very soon on who will be doing that work. And we are continuing, because of the funding we've also received from the state of Delaware, to do additional work needed on the building, which would include a work on the basement area, the interior work of the church building. We also will connect the adjacent social hall building. It's a cinder block building that we think was constructed maybe in the 1940s. And we will connect the two buildings with a hallway or hyphen, as the architects like to call it, and join the two buildings together. Right now, the building has been electrified, both buildings. We have been meeting visitors. In fact, this coming Friday, a architectural group will be visiting us to see the building as it currently stands, and hopefully we'll receive some advice or suggestions on the project from them.
How do you balance all of this in terms of what needs are most pressing versus what you determine can wait?
Well, we relied on our architect to establish a budget for all the work that was needed. And then it was further refined by the construction manager. And the total project cost currently stands at about $950,000. We expect probably by the time of the completion, it'll probably be in excess of $1 million. So we have sufficient funds to probably do maybe 75% of the construction work that's going to be needed for the building. In addition to that, we have also applied for and have been approved for Delaware state tax credits, which would be awarded upon completion of the entire project. And we would hope to realize something on the order of maybe $200,000 from that effort. So we think we're pretty well there. We just need to get these trades moving forward and beginning to do the work that's needed.
So Zor Methodist Episcopal Church was established in 1845. We know it was notably an underground railroad stop for enslaved Black people seeking freedom in the North. But walk us through the church's background and what our listeners should know about it.
The legacy of the building is that it was quite possibly an underground railroad stop. It's always difficult, you know, for historians to say absolutely for fact that it happened. But we believe, or we've been led to believe that it was a stop. You know, of course, prior to the start of the Civil War, the church was formed by a group of freed and enslaved Black parishioners who decided that they wanted their own place of worship. And so they purchased a small piece of property on Osborne Street in Odessa. We were also able to acquire that little triangular piece. And what we hope to do with that site is to create a little park area, fence it in with pavers and benches and plantings that will celebrate the site of the original location of that church. And as the congregation grew, they outgrew that site, and that's led them to acquire the property where the present building, church building, stands. The cornerstone was laid in 1881, and they would continue to worship up until the mid-70s or so. Following that, it kind of went into limited use. The congregation was dwindling, and we're told the last event that was held on the site was a reunion service in around 2015. They couldn't meet in the building. It was not habitable, so they met outside. And we would hope that we'd be able to extend an invitation to the descendants of those members to hold yet again reunion services to celebrate the church.
Now, let's fast forward to when Zor is fully restored or most of the way there. How do you envision the church not only looking, but what are your plans for how it operates once it reopens its doors?
Well, that's a good question. And we've been so focused, frankly, on the construction and restoration work. We did hold a planning meeting last summer, a strategic planning meeting. And we had a consultant come in and guide us in that process. And so what we think that will do is give us a basis for how the building will operate, what kinds of events and activities we would see. But we hope it would become a community center, a cultural center, celebrating the history of the building and that congregation. We would expect to hold celebrations during, for example, Black History Month, Martin Luther King's birthday, Juneteenth celebration. We also hope it would become a place where various groups could come, enjoy music and various other arts type programs. And beyond that, it will be whatever we think it's reasonable for it to be.
Do you have a target date for when you like to open, or a goal, or is that still to be determined?
Well, I think it's to be determined, but we certainly have sufficient funding to take us, as I said earlier, about three quarters of the way through the budget. So our hope is that by in another 24 months or so, we'd be nearly completed with the project. So that's our hope.
Thanks to the Friends of Zor Treasurer Stephen Johnson and our Joe Irizarry for showing us why history matters this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry and Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.